Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Football aside, obviously, it's not been a particularly good season, I guess. I was going to say particularly good week or 2 weeks or last 24 hours or something, but, you know, it's not been a good season. And now it's over. There are still four games in the Premier League, but let's face it, the end is here. We went out of the Europa League last night with a tepid, uninspiring, unenergetic 0-0 draw with Villarreal that lacked the kind of energy and intensity and occasion that you would expect from a game like this, a performance like this. It was not good. We had a couple of moments, but really the football we played over the two legs, nobody can say we deserve to be in the Europa League final. And nobody could say, based on that, that if we were somehow to win that Europa League final, we would have been worthy of Champions League football. I know that would have been the outcome, and I would have taken it and grasped it with both hands, but sometimes you reap what you sow, and we sowed the seeds of nothingness with a performance that, I don't know, it raises many questions. Many questions about what happens next. Why can't we play on big occasions? Why can't we play on small occasions? I know there are factors like, you know, fans would have made a difference, but Villarreal didn't have fans in their first leg at home. So, you know, these things work both ways. There are no excuses for the way we played last night. There are no excuses for the season that we've had. It's been way, way, way below the standards that are acceptable for Arsenal Football Club, even if you accept that there are mitigating factors, that there are things to sort out and things to rebuild, and that it is going to be a bit of a slow process. And I use that word in its true sense rather than the sort of Arsenal meme sense at the moment. You know, this squad and this group of players may not be perfect, but I think it's better than what we've seen this season. It should certainly be way above mid-table. We should have, at the very least, been competitive against Villarreal, and we weren't. And look, you can't go through a season like this without there being a post-mortem, where you ask, what happened, why did it happen, and what happens next? And who decides what happens next, and when should it happen? Or, you know, look, there are so many things that we can discuss and things that we will discuss on this particular show. So I think I'll just park the kind of the build-up commentary to this and just get on with the discussion and welcome our guest. First up, Tayo Papula. Hi, Tayo.
Hey, mate, how are you? Well, silly question, but hello. Let's just go for that.
Yeah, let's go for that. Yeah. Introspection can come later. And also with us, Tim Stillman. Hello, Tim.
Hello there.
Tayo, can I start with you? We have, all of us, I think, as Arsenal fans, a breadth and depth of experience of things going wrong and also imaginations. And I could envisage a number of ways in which Arsenal went out of the Europa League to an Unai Emery team. I didn't quite expect it to be as tepid and magnolia as it was last night. And then there's another part of me that thinks, well, you've watched Arsenal all season long. Am I just stupid for not thinking that this was the kind of performance we could produce?
No, I mean, that's what Captain Hindsight's for, but you're totally right. I think there's been a general, with good reason, there's a general feeling that when the time comes, we'll step up. It will be different. You keep thinking it will be different. How many times have we heard, because we're Arsenal? right? Yeah. Like, and it's, but so to, so afterwards, having gone out in such a way, it is so unbelievably frustrating and makes perfect sense the day after. But yeah, like watching it happen in slow motion, you know, like when I was thinking, you know, when you're having a dream, have you ever tried to have a fight in a dream?
Mm.
And you just can't,
you can't punch.
Like, you can't punch. And you're watching yourself not being able to punch, and it's just really, really frustrating. And that's sort of how I felt yesterday. I couldn't believe it was happening. I couldn't believe they couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't believe that we couldn't do anything about it. And it just felt so helpless. And as you say, really, really beige.
Slow motion is a really good way of putting it, Tim, isn't it? Because you look for, and just to sort of put the context on this, we are going to discuss the game a little bit, but then broaden it out to the wider issues and the consequences of the game. So slow motion seems about right, because there was nothing in that first half. There wasn't much in the first leg. You know, to play three halves of a game, or three quarters of two games, or whatever way you want to put it. I'm confusing myself here, but you know what I mean? 45 minutes and another 45 minutes and another 45 minutes where, you know, it's pretty toothless. You can't really expect to go through when you waste that much of a tie.
No, indeed. And that's been a theme of the run in the knockouts, really, where usually we waste the first leg somehow, and then pull it back and do the hero football in the second leg. And you always had the impression that that wasn't going to cut mustard come semi-final time, and that we were going to, and definitely not in a prospective final either, because the quality of the opposition goes up. And yeah, slow motion is a great way of putting it. I mean, of the 180 minutes of the tie, I'd say generously, maybe Villarreal controlled 150 minutes of it. Whether it was the first leg because they were creating chances and looked the better team, or the second leg where they just had us at arm's length, I think half an hour of the entire tie is probably quite a generous approximation of how much of the tie we really looked dangerous. And what was quite depressing about it is I rushed the column out this week for Wednesday because I wanted it before the game, and at the risk of kind of self-aggrandizing here, it's all there. The torturously slow build up, the failure to put teams under pressure, the under prioritizing of things like having shots on goal, taking players on, getting the ball in the area, versus kind of really intensely choreographed pattern play that takes an absolute age to get into the final third. And we just we didn't stress Villarreal at any point. And I think that's what really depressed me about last night. I think when you watch a lot of football, you pick up like an emotional intelligence for it. Sometimes often that emotion can cloud your judgment, but I think you get a real feel for a game. And after about 20 minutes, I thought to myself, right, this is either going to have to be another penalty, Pepe is going to have to spank one in from 30 yards, or Aubameyang's going to have to pull something out of his arsehole out of nothing. And only one of those things nearly happened.
Yeah, I mean, we did have a couple of near misses, Tayo, with Aubameyang hitting the post in the first half and then hitting the post in the second half. The kind of chance that had it happened up the other end would unquestionably have bounced off the post, off the back of Leno's head, and gone in. So I'm not, you know, putting it down to bad luck or anything like that, but Arteta's anguish at those missed chances, I think, is quite telling, not simply because they're missed chances. And I think this is something that Tim has touched on in his columns and elsewhere as well. You know, simply missed chances like that feel so much worse when you know they're so few and far between in games.
No, 100%. I think, it feels like we're doing ourselves, it feels like we're making ourselves feel better by saying we had the, you hear Arteta saying we had the chances to win this. One of them was, complete opportunism from, and I think it fell to him after a corner for the first one off the post. Albeit one of Blair Lewin's crosses found something like the right position for the second one. But the Smith Rowe one so early on. Again, there's two halves. Tim talks about emotional intelligence. There's two halves of my Arsenal brain at work. There's the one that says we'll get some more chances because we're Arsenal. But there was the other one, really and truly, as you say, Tim, with Smith Rowe's kind of scoop chance before you, it felt there's so much more weight on that one as well, because we were so the sort of paucity of chances up front, the paucity of just over the 180 minutes of chance creation was just so was so depressing. And the fact that, you know, our only thing to show for this is Saka winning the penalty in the first half, it just felt, as time went on, that you're looking at, there could have been 10 minutes extra time, I wouldn't have had that that lift that we've had, like, from 72 minutes. I remember looking at the clock at 72 minutes and just thinking, normally, again, you'd think we've got 20 minutes here to go barnstorming. But we're also talking about very tired players who are very confused and tired players, and there just did not seem to be any kind of impetus for that last 20 minutes. So, yeah, every single half chance, and they never felt like really big chances still. And that in itself is depressing as well, with so much at stake.
Yeah, I mean, especially considering the state of their goalkeeper, who was, like, coming and flapping and punching and, like, bailed out by his defenders time and time again, you know. So a goalkeeper like that, who we really failed to trouble and put any pressure on over the course of two legs, is really something. But, Tim, where do you stand on the, you know, it's difficult to talk about intangibles, but when we use words like energy and intensity and urgency, some people might say, well, that's got nothing to do with it. You can't measure those, so you can't really talk about them. But I think you can. I think you can look at a performance and you can say there wasn't the right urgency, there wasn't the energy, there wasn't the intensity, there wasn't the drive, there wasn't the bravery on the ball, all of those things which, look, you can't measure them in stats. There are no metrics for you know, X urgency and all that kind of stuff. But they're still important factors in a football game. And I know people will say, look, part of it is because you don't have fans. And look, if you have fans in the stadium, I think it creates a different dynamic. But, you know, that's something that both teams have had to contend with over the course of two legs. It feels to me really like, you know, Arteta is a meticulous guy. He's full of ideas, and he's got, you know, I don't feel like this team went into this game underprepared, like they didn't work on as much as possible on the training ground. Is it possible that they are simply suffocated by too many ideas, that things have to work within a certain structure or a certain pattern, and any deviation from that is, it feels like the players aren't really willing to take risks outside of those patterns?
Yeah, I think that's perfectly valid. And we can see it in his selections. Up before last night, Pepe had only played 30 minutes more than Willian this season. What does that tell you? Look at Martinelli, for example. And on one hand, I think it's been right to be patient about Martinelli. He's just come off of a long injury. He's young. We do actually have, and this is another thing that I find a bit depressing, I do actually think we have a reasonably good attack. Like, I look at the squad and I think talent-wise, that's top-heavy. That there's quite a lot of attackers there. And someone like Willian, like, if by some miracle we could get rid of Willian this summer, I don't think we need to sign anyone to replace him. I think the players are already there and he's clogging things up, frankly. And so, you know, you look at the treatment of some of the players who perhaps are a little bit more instinctive, a little bit more improvisational, even Aubameyang, who isn't necessarily in, well, he is an instinctive player, but in a different way. It's not in the build-up, it's in the penalty area. But you can see that you can see what Arteta's preferences are. And that's kind of fine as long as it works. And it's quite strange, really, because we've, as Arsenal fans, we've craved more structure for probably more than a decade. We've been thinking, oh my God, we need some structure to this. Like the free-form jazz football is great when it works, but there needs to be a bit more. And we've done that thing that a lot of teams do when they've got a problem and they kind of go too far the other way. And I feel like we're in that, we've long since reached that zone where we've gone too far the other way. And you can see why the players responded to it at first, because it was an antidote to Emery, which became really structureless and a different formation every week. But this ultimately, like, Arteta's just been sucked into this Arsenal black hole. I think the same way Emery was, where he came in with an idea probably thought, maybe I don't have the players to do this. And he's been switching ever since and frankly flailing a little bit ever since. But look, if you want to like win leagues and get in the top four and things like that, you've got to be scoring goals in the treble figures in a season. And we are, you can't score the perfect goal every time. There has to be room for something else other than like one very intensely choreographed way of scoring goals.
Tayo, we talked about the disruption before the game, and obviously Granit Xhaka was penciled in to start and didn't because he picked up an injury in the warm-up, and he sort of spoke afterwards about how disruptive that was. And look, it's never easy to lose a player who's, you know, been in the plans before the game, but like, if your game plan is a midfielder at left back and your replacement for that midfielder at left back is the best left back you have at the club, even if he was 60-70% fit, it shouldn't be that difficult to cope with. Like, if your game plan could be undone by one injury in the warm-up, it suggests that maybe your game plan isn't as solid as you thought.
Yeah, and before I answer that properly, it's worth acknowledging James's part, James Gullerblog's part in this, having mentioned, like, I genuinely winced on last week's pod when he went, well, you know, as we know, Granit Xhaka absolutely never gets injured. James, absolutely leave it. It was marked from that point, but you're right. I think something that Tim said about the attacking options that we have at the club, again, you look at the team sheet and you keep thinking, oh yeah, all right. But one of the reasons why that is such a problem is because of the paucity of creativity in midfield. And that was laid bare yesterday with Thomas Partey trying to be a one-man midfield at a time when he himself is kind of struggling with form. So when you have a situation where his natural partner is already out of position and therefore we're going to suffer for him being playing in his hybrid position...
Mm.
That was laying bare yesterday. And the fact that Kieran Tierney was, I mean, every time I saw him in their half of the pitch, I was worried because he was clearly not, you know, he's clearly not fit. He's clearly, Kieran Tierney is going to kind of push through it.
Mm.
But the fact that, you know, you got Elneny's, understandably not trusted. Ceballos has been a problem in that position. And there was no chance to attack properly because without David Luiz and Granit Xhaka in their normal positions, we're going to keep on having this problem. So I guess to answer your question about if that's your only game plan, he's partially hampered by the players that are available to him, partially hampered by injury. But the fact that, as you say, the fact that this game plan is based around such specifics with players who aren't in their natural position anyway, yes, of course it's flawed. There are so many factors, as I say, with injury and with tiredness and players being forced to play in different positions. Don't play in such a stringent, rigid way if you don't have the personnel. And if you're the person and without any kind of plan B, with the more instinctive players kind of shackled because of your system, then we don't have the players or the squad to have anything else apart from we don't have the players without unless everything goes absolutely perfect. And as Tim says, that we've craved this for ages. What you're kind of seeing now is like, you know, when an Allardyce goes into a club, a relegation club or whatever, the conversation is, right, well, let's try and repair the first thing you do is try and repair the damage that's been done. And guess what you're seeing with Arteta now? It's like when you've got, like, as we've all had in this lockdown, you've got loads of work to do. And instead of doing it, you think, well, I'll just tidy the living room. So that's the easy bit. We've stopped the goals coming in, but haven't done enough to win football matches as 13 defeats and all those draws early on in the season show.
Tim, do you think like the players I mean, is it a question that Arteta is too controlling? I mean, we're speculating, obviously. We're only going on what we're seeing. But, you know, the reluctance of the manager to leave his team exposed is there's a direct correlation between that and the lack of attacking threat, in that he won't give the players the license to go forward. I mean, he's always talked about scoring goals and trying to create an attacking team, but what he said and what he's done have been two different things. Like, what he says he wants and what he then produces from his players on the pitch are directly opposite at times.
Yeah, absolutely. He has my sympathy in a number of ways, to be fair. Like, this squad is better than this, but the problem with it isn't really just the talent level. It's just such a hodgepodge of players who really don't fit together. And so he kind of has my sympathy in terms of, it's hard to leave the back door open with Arsenal, because we've seen what that gets us. And to be fair, it's probably slightly better than this, but it's still not good enough. So we've kind of seen that. That said, he did spend £30 million on a central defender to kind of help us do that, and has now decided not to play him
in the biggest game of the season. Yeah, I mean, this was his signing. Here's an Edu signing. This is the kind of game where you think, okay, look, I know defense wasn't the issue. We're not really talking about defense, but it does speak to like a lack of coherence or cohesion in the recruitment side of things when your £30 million signing, you know, who for a long time was our biggest signing of last summer, can't get in the team for a European semi-final for a guy, with all due respect to Pablo Mari, like, has been a journeyman who went from Man City to the Eredivisie and to the Spanish second division and then to Brazil. Like, his trajectory to a club like Arsenal has been unconventional, to say the least. And I don't think he was a big problem or anything last night, but it is telling in another way.
Yeah, exactly. Like, two of the big signings from last summer, in Gabriel and Willian, weren't trusted, weren't started. And he took Aubameyang off. I'm sure we'll talk about that, but he took Aubameyang off after 80 minutes, which to me is the kind of decision a manager makes just before he's sacked, when you go, oh my God, this guy has really lost it now.
It's his
Ruud Gullit and Alan Shearer moment.
Right. Well, just expand on that, because the other side of that is that he's just come back from malaria. He talked about, you know, how wrecked he was. I mean, I personally, given how badly we were playing and the fact that the two big chances we had fell to Aubameyang, I would absolutely have left him on and then just said, we'll take a couple of weeks off here. Particularly when afterwards he talked about Alexandre Lacazette and said really all he had in him was 10 or 15 minutes. Like, yeah, a guy coming back from a hamstring strain who's not like an impact sub or anything like that. That was a really odd decision for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of, so first of all, I don't really see that much difference between 80 minutes and 90 minutes. Yeah. If he'd taken Aubameyang off after an hour, you say, all right, fair enough. But I mean, he played 76 minutes against Newcastle. So look, in the circumstances, which were absolute kitchen sink, whole season riding on this, I don't care if Aubameyang's on fucking crutches. You keep him in that penalty area. He's had your only chances. He is the only player who from open play produced any shots on target across both legs, and he only came on for the last few minutes of the second leg. So you absolutely keep him on, particularly when he's just hit the post. And I mean, we're probably not in the mood to go back and look at it in it triumphantly, but look at that second Aubameyang chance again. That has not been put on his head. That's not you know, the Benfica goal where Saka puts in a brilliant cross and it's just on a plate. That is, he's got two guys marking him. They both jump with him. It's a decent cross from Hector Bellerin. It's not an absolute give me. That is a guy who is fighting tooth and nail to try and score a goal. That is, he's got up, he's fought off two defenders to get that header in. That, like, he didn't look weak in that situation to me. And then, I mean, to compound it by bringing in Nketiah on a few minutes later, I think exposes the extent to which there wasn't really a plan here. But it beggars belief, really. Sometimes you don't need to think of it any more simply than, he is our best goal scorer and we really need a goal. And look, we're in this position where we try to craft the perfect chance. And if you're going to do that, then Aubameyang's the guy you want in the area. So I just found that absolutely unbelievable. And like you say, he didn't have to play again till May the 26th if we didn't want him to, if it was really that draining, or he could have had like a 10-minute run out in all of the Premier League games left. I just think, like, if last night was the final, would he have done that? If we, let's say we go through to the final and there's 10 minutes to go and we're 1-0 down to Man United, does he take Aubameyang off? I'm not so sure. I think, again, it was just, it was too clever by half. He kind of thought, I want to bring Lacazette on, but I must not change the formation. The formation must stay exactly the same, and therefore I've got to do a straight swap. And it's really symptomatic of his really poor substitutions, and there's no sign of improvement there.
I think what was so surprising is because, yeah, what was so baffling about that moment is that we've talked about a manager who is so rigid, which of course he is, but then the lack of any kind of attacking plan in that last 20, 25 minutes, including the substitution, including the players being thrown on, is all the more baffling and had us all shouting at our screens yesterday. Going back to the attacking options that we had and going back to the fact that there was nothing on offer for them in the midfield, the amount of touches, what is it? How many touches did Aubameyang have in the game?
14.
14.
And seven in each half and almost scored twice. So,
which is bonkers. There's a point where if there were fans in the ground, you'd hear that collective frustration as the players turned back to start again, like, you know, turn back in midfield and start again. You always used to hear that at home when there was that frustration. Adding to then the fact that we don't have the players on the pitch who can play from the back, the way that Arteta wants to play football is not in sync with the players that he has. And the fact that he seems unable to change that is why he seems so open today. Emery didn't. I mean, Villarreal were bang average, and we played them to the point where they were comfortable. We had our time with Unai Emery, so we know that the second half was the second leg's perfect for him. First of all, they fluked their way to 2-0 up because we were so abject in the first leg. So of course, then simple things like, yes, they pressed fairly. You know, they pressed well. Mm. They talked it up a bit too much, I thought yesterday. They just played like a decent football team with no attacking threat. And should have been at least tested a bit more yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I know what you're saying about the attacking side of things, but, you know, it would be reasonable to say that, like, look, in the final 20 minutes, 25 minutes, whatever it was, you know, I think we can over egg the pudding of tactics, if you like. And there is kind of one tactic when you're in a semi-final, when you have to score. I know it's probably not in the coaching manuals, but throw the fucking kitchen sink at it seems like a pretty good plan to me, Tayo. So, you know, when you have Aubameyang, when you've got Smith Rowe, when you've got Saka, when you've got Odegaard, when you've got Martinelli, when you've got Pepe on the pitch, you know, you do have players who, if they're given some license or some freedom or some kind of structure, even in which they can get the ball forward. Look, Villarreal were well organized. They pressed us well. We didn't really press them well in return. But, you know, that lack, as we talked about earlier, that lack of intensity, that lack of urgency, that lack of just something, you know, that desperation sometimes can be a tactic as well, where you make something happen by virtue of just, like, you're desperate. You know, you'll try things, you'll attempt things, you'll risk things. There was none of that.
Yeah, do you know what? I think that I genuinely think, watching that yesterday, I don't think they knew how to throw the kitchen sink.
I think that's right.
At Villarreal yesterday. I genuinely don't think they knew how to, you know, there'd be the odd long ball up from the back, which would sail out into touch. I mean, we had in the first leg, obviously, there's that Partey chance, Partey ball, sorry, through to Aubameyang. How important did we not know that would be? Or as you probably did. But I can't think of any, like, kitchen sink type shots. I can't think of too many long balls into the box. I can't think of too many times where we had, you know, six attackers pressed on their but on their 18 yard line. Can you think of one?
No.
So I don't know as players whether they seem tired, but they also just seem baffled.
Mm.
You know, if Saka's not gonna. If Saka's not going to do what he's done far too many times this season, if a Smith Rowe first touch isn't like fashioning at least half a break between the lines, mm. I didn't see anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about momentum and building pressure and applying pressure and keeping it going, Tim, which we never did and never did in the two legs. You know, you can remember many times under Arsene Wenger, for example, where we'd need a goal and, you know, literally we have camped in their half and we recycle the ball and we try and open them up and they clear it and we come back and we come back and we come back. We didn't always get a goal, but you know, your chances of getting a goal are much, much higher when you play that way. And I can't remember really any occasion, not just this season, but since Mikel Arteta took over, where we've been able to play in that way in games where we've needed goals. We've been tidy and what have you, but there's never been that ability to put pressure on teams. And I think Villarreal, it was obvious early on that they looked at what Saka did last week and they didn't let him do it again. They, you know, that period in the second half of the first leg where Saka literally just tried to make something happen for us over and over and over again in that kind of right-hand channel he cut inside towards the box, and from there he won the penalty, and there were other moments as well. They cut off that line. They cut off that space for him to work his magic is not the right word, but to, you know, to where he can be effective. So, you know, they were well organized, but we just don't appear to be able as a team to mount any serious pressure on the opposition for any sustained period in a game.
No, and this is where that West Ham game is a bit of an outlier and perhaps gave us false hope at the time, because that's one of the only times I remember us doing it, at the point that we went 3-0 down there. And it's difficult to separate in hindsight how much that was Arsenal and how much that was Ødegaard just having a bit of a blinder. I think we have acknowledged the ways in which Arteta's, you know, been unlucky with injuries. Like he's been, it's a bit unfortunate to come into this period where Tierney, Aubameyang and Ødegaard, just as he looks like he's about to go supernova, gets injured. But like, that is unfortunate, and I do think losing Xhaka was unfortunate. Probably not so much for Arteta, but I think it was fortunate for Emery, in that one of the things that Villarreal did really well was block up the wide areas, as you referenced there with Saka. And actually probably having Tierney at left back instead of Xhaka played into that even more, because one of the things, we know that Emery does his homework, probably to a fault, but we know you don't have to watch Arsenal much to understand that Arsenal kind of empty the middle of the pitch. They always have done. They go out wide, and he was putting players there. I mean, I haven't seen the average position charts, but someone like Coquelin, I mean, Coquelin was almost playing like another fullback at times. Yeah. They were just really focused on blocking up those wide areas. And one of the reasons Smith Rowe was one of the few, possibly the only Arsenal player to stick out on the night, was he was one of the few players who offered anything centrally. And it's quite a weird pattern for a game to take, because usually you would expect a team primarily wants to attack through the middle, and when they can't do that, they go out wide as a bit of a concession. But what happened against Villarreal was Arsenal's plan A was to go wide, and then they didn't really have a plan B, when actually the centre of the pitch was probably a bit more of an enterprising avenue for them. But this is an absolute season long problem, and one of the best ways I can think of to phrase it is, how many half chances can you recall, just thinking, you know, over the course of this season and Arteta's reign, there aren't many like half chances. And it's all those kind of shots that flash over the bar or something. Like it's either you know, the choreographed plan works and we get a shot, or it doesn't and we don't. And usually what good teams do, as you say, is the death by a thousand cuts stuff. And you look at the way Liverpool play, for example, their central midfielders don't actually score many more goals than ours. But what they do is they're really focused on picking up clearances. And if you if you watch, I mean, he might not be at Liverpool much longer, but someone pointed out to me about a year ago, when you watch Liverpool, watch every clearance where it goes, it just goes to Wijnaldum every time. It's uncanny. And when you notice it, you can't unnotice it, because Liverpool really work on this basis of keeping teams under pressure. Mm. And Wijnaldum's job is not to score goals. It's, I'm going to pick up the clearance and then I'm going to give it again to Salah or Robertson or whoever. And we just don't have that. And it just, it doesn't cause any stress. And, you know, we, a lot of us spoke before this game saying kind of, yeah, Emery, it's Emery. He's going to go for the nil-nil, almost kind of mockingly, which I understand, because usually I wouldn't advise that. But actually coming to the Emirates at the moment, I think it's not difficult to get a nil-nil.
No, I mean, considering it's, what is it, a club record, 10 games this season at home without scoring, Tayo. So this is a bigger issue. You know, I think we've kind of done the game itself at this point, and we need to broaden this out and start talking about what the consequences of this might be. And I think they're obvious from a football point of view, aren't they, that, you know, we, the last chance of any tangible success or making this season in any way acceptable lay on last night's game, and it fell by the wayside. Like Tim's there, death by a thousand cuts. Arsenal, death by 11 cunts, but that seems a bit harsh on on some of the kids who I really felt sorry for last night. You know, Smith Rowe did play with bravery, and Saka has played really well this season and everything else. So, you know, where in the annals of recent history does this season sit for you? I mean, this is going back to the 90s in terms of where we are and how far below expectations it is.
The last time we were this bad, I guess I was in my early 20s and we had Ian Wright. So I still managed to enjoy it. The thing to say this time is that, and I'm not just being pithy by saying that, because there was still an enjoyment and excitement going to the games still, because something was going to happen. Plus we were, you know, we had my favourite player and we had a decent back four kind of thing. The excitement here is the fact that we do have, the excitement here is Saka and Smith Rowe.
Martinelli,
but this has been the beigest, most disappointing season, because nothing's happened anymore. I mean, there was almost like there was a weird. Certainly didn't enjoy it, but the Emery stuff. There was a weird. There's always been a weird kind of how bad can it get before it gets better again? And here it feels like. A very long road. I mean, we're talking about a club. We have, you know, these kind of quote unquote Bank of England values, and having had a legacy manager, I think you mentioned it this morning, actually, having had a legacy manager for so long, there is the intent to try and do that again. But we're trying to operate with kind of, again, it's this dual Arsenal personality. We're trying to operate with kind of the Arsenal. We're trying to operate in an Arsenal way with a board and a structure higher than the manager, which has done everything contrary to that. So stasis and inertia seems to have kind of gripped the club and gripped my feeling about the club at the moment.
Where do you think this leaves Mikel Arteta, Tim? You know, under normal circumstances, a manager at a club like Arsenal who presides over 13 Premier League defeats, team is in mid-table, not going to qualify for Europe, has gone out of Europe at the semi-final stage, not in any kind of heroic, valiant way, but in a really insipid, tepid way, to a manager who the club sacked 18 months previously. You know, it's very difficult to make a case that the current manager could survive something like that. And I'm not making a case for that either. I'm just trying to put it in context. Is there anything to be said for the circumstances at Arsenal being markedly different from any other club to provide some mitigation for that? In that, look, everybody's had to deal with COVID. Everybody's had to deal with financial restrictions. Everybody's had to deal with no preseason. Everyone's had to deal with injuries and those kind of things. Excuse me. But no club has had to deal with the Wenger thing, the Gazidis thing, the Mislintat thing, the Sanjehi thing, the various issues that Arsenal have had to deal with. Like, I feel like I wanted it to work for Arteta badly. I feel like his heart is in the right place. I really feel like he genuinely wants to do a good job for the club. I think he absolutely nailed some of the problems that we have, or identified some of those problems. You know, there was a need to get rid of some of the messers and the chancers that we had at the club, and he's done some of that with the backing of the board, et cetera, et cetera. We can all see that there's a rebuilding job needing to be done, but you have to be able to do that as well as produce acceptable, at a minimum, acceptable results on the pitch. And that's where we have the issue.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two sides to this, I think, in terms of Arsenal haven't supported him. And that's somewhere where he really has my sympathy. It's really clear. It was really clear at the time, not even in hindsight, this kind of promoting him to manager thing was, we've given up on the whole structure thing.
Yeah.
So we're just really hoping that you really are brilliant and we can just let you run everything.
That's it. I mean, they asked him to manage not just the team, but the club.
Yeah.
They made him the manager of the club. Maybe off the back of his good ideas or you know, the vision that he sold them. But, you know, in hindsight, you know, that's way too much for a guy of his inexperience to have to deal with.
Way, way too much. And it's a real, like, the Arsenal job is a difficult job at the moment. It's not impossible, but it's difficult because The thing was trying to judge Arteta, right, was we never appointed him on the manager he is, but the manager we thought he could be.
Mm.
And we were kind of betting on the next big thing. And I had sympathy for that because I kind of thought we had to do that. Really, the only two choices, appealing choices on the market at the time, were taking that risk with Arteta or going for someone like Ancelotti, who a lot more experienced, but probably on the downslide in terms of his career. I don't think he's done amazing things at Everton. So I can see why we eschewed that option, and there wasn't a lot else out there. So I do understand why they thought, okay, let's gamble on the next big thing. And we know this guy, and he knows the club, et cetera, et cetera. So I can see the decision-making, and I was broadly supportive of it at the time, but the lack of support, you know, inside the club. Like, Arsenal is a very young club, even at executive level, Per Mertesacker, et cetera, et cetera. So he hasn't been given the level of support. And then, you know, really alarm bells are ringing when he's being asked to negotiate pay cuts with players and things like that. And that is a leadership vacuum right there. That should be Stan and Josh Kroenke doing that, let alone Vinay or Edu. But the manager doing it, that is really pushing down. That is delegation to the extreme. That is not within his pay grade, regardless of his level of experience. That is not his job at all. And that's real alarm bells ringing when he's being asked to do stuff like that. And so he really has my sympathy there. I do also think, though, he hasn't supported himself. This is pop psychology, and I could be completely wrong, but something Jens Lehmann said, and I know the words something Jens Lehmann said this week are particularly sensitive, but I'm not referring to that incident, but something he said a few months ago, when Arteta's stock was a bit higher, and he said it seems to be a lot about him. And I've had that feeling as well. I feel like Arteta is trying to project the image of a good coach, and that he really wants the reputation. And to some extent, he already had that reputation as a great manager in waiting. And I think he really wanted that, and he really wanted to drive through some of that, which is why some of his communication, the way he presents himself, projects himself, et cetera, like, he'd give a cracking PowerPoint. I've got absolutely no doubts about that whatsoever. And that's, like, that's important. Communication's important. But I just feel like he's got too wrapped up in the projecting the image of a good coach rather than, you know, taking lots of shots on goal and winning football games and things like that. And when it came to appointing backroom staff, I had this really fleeting moment, and I never verbalized it, and I really regret it, because when he was first appointed, I think I'm right in saying that David Moyes was out of a job, and I thought, I wouldn't mind bringing Moyes into the coaching staff just to have like that bit of experience around him. And instead he kind of went for guys who I don't doubt are good coaches, but I don't see a lot of challenge there, you know, and I don't see, you know, his issue with substitutions, for example. It's completely understandable that he has that issue. The guys around him have never managed either. They've never had to make substitutions. They've never had to manage like a situation like Ozil or Guendouzi or something like that. And then do you remember last summer he brought in some admittedly lower level coaching staff and they're all in their 20s? And that I thought, that's a bit, I'm making myself the big man at this club. And I just feel like he's gotten too kind of wrapped up in the, I need to project the image of authority, the image of success. And he's actually forgot about doing the things that give you authority and success. And some of that is deferring. Some of that is admitting your weaknesses and surrounding yourself with people who help you with those weaknesses. And the example I'd give is Bertie Mee, right? We appointed Bertie Mee, who's the physio. And the first thing he did was he went and got Dave Sexton. Then he got Don Howe, because he was like, I'm not a coach. That's not what I'm here for. I need to bring in a coach to really kind of bring that up. And I really, really feel he was maybe a bit too proud to bring in that level of experience around him. And I am sure when he looks back in 5, 10 years, 20 years, whatever happens with his coaching career, I'm sure he'll say, I regret not swallowing my pride a little bit and perhaps bringing in more of that experience around me. But then again, maybe that should be the club's job.
And I think, well, you just ended what I was going to start with. And I think he's been allowed to think like that because of the laziness and the hands-off approach at executive level. So you've got a combination of a guy who's come across extremely confidently, which we all bought into at first. And because of the hands-off approach of the Kroenkes, and because of the dismantling of a team around him, because of the promotion to him as manager, they also want to believe the facsimile that he's put out, that he's totally in control and totally comfortable. It's easier for them to be able to say, well, this guy's projecting him. Like, I mean, Unai Emery felt like he could be walked over from higher up. Arteta doesn't give off that image. And that, first of all, projects very well for us at first when things were going better, and now becomes a problem. Like, having talked so much about taking the power away from one man who controlled the club for 20 odd years, having an executive structure, which we've watched just fall apart over the last 2 years, 2 years, 3 years. We watched that struck from Gazidis to everyone leaving, to Sanlehi leaving, to the problems with Mislintat and so forth. We've now gone back to a situation where they're trying to hand over the running of a club to one man. And guess what? This one man, before he got to us, hadn't managed a football team before and is now being asked to do everything with all the stuff going on in the background and isn't provided and doesn't have the results or the talent or the personality to be the shield that the previous legacy manager had. And that's one of the biggest problems at the club, the fact that there's no one around for that. As you say, Tim, with the younger coaches, there's no one around for a check and a balance anymore.
I mean, Tayo, even when he was made the manager, September last year, where they appointed him manager, promoted him to manager from head coach, and the technical director is Edu, and it felt a little bit at the time, considering Edu's close relationship with Raul Sanyehi and what had come before, that he was a little bit lucky to hang on to his job, to me anyway. And in promoting Arteta as manager, you consolidate the football power and knowledge, in inverted commas, in one man. The manager should not be the boss of the technical director at a football club. manager slash head coach, you know, the guy who's in charge of the team, you know, the technical director should be putting in place the pieces, the transfers, you know, the kind of players that we're going to bring in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because, like, managers come and go. Technical director could stay there for 5, 10, 15 years, but managers, head coaches come and go. So the technical director's job is to put in places the pieces for a manager or a head coach to work with within the structures that you as a club define. So how do you want to play? What kind of players do you want? How do you fit those players into the formation, et cetera, et cetera? But what we got was a situation where basically it felt like Edu was not quite Arteta's lapdog, but he was very much second fiddle to Arteta. And now you have a situation where the manager, the guy in whom you've invested all this power and all this trust, is the guy who is right now, and rightly so because of everything that's come, the one who's most under pressure. So you have this weird skewed dynamic where the guy who's under pressure is also the guy who you have basically handed the reins of running the football club to, who fires themselves, you know.
We've got it ass backwards, as you said, which is what makes, I think, this morning or these current weeks so poignant, because the reason why Arteta is more under threat than perhaps he would be, if you want to talk about the process, if you want to talk about the kind of season that we've had, that football's had and the problems that are around. The reason why there's a bit more pressure around is because he has assumed this responsibility because it has been handed over, because there isn't the protection there where you say, look, this is a man who's worked under difficult circumstances at a difficult time and is doing his best. Because of the extra responsibility, that, my friends, is why he's in more of the firing line today. And that's why he's got to accept it. And of course, look, he accepts his job's under threat. And he said that yesterday, but he's also said, like a man who knows that he's got more say in this than perhaps he should do. So yeah, we've got everything upside down. And the club have also weirdly backed him with the signing of Willian, with the 30 million spent on
Gabriel.
On Gabriel, but it is also on him with the treatment of our other massive outlay at centre half, Saliba, and the issues there, and the not trust and not trusting big players, but also not having a great solution for it on the other side. So he's more in the firing line because of these kind of enhanced position at the club.
Tim, I mean, look, Arteta's job, I personally don't think they're going to make a change. I could be wrong. I could be surprised, but I don't think they're going to make a change. Having done what they did in January by sort of backing him and saying, look, we need to get rid of these guys. We need rid of Ozil and Mustafi and Socrates and whoever the hell else, Kolasinac, that little coterie on the training ground. He felt it wasn't positive. They backed him and they got rid of that. And they backed him with Partey. They backed him with Gabriel, you know. So I would be surprised, but is not the biggest issue the executive structure at the club, in that we know that the Kroenkes are absentees. We know that, but this all boils down to that absenteeism and their inability to do their due diligence and to go through the right kind of, I hate to use the word, processes to put people in charge of their football club. Like, you know, literally, when Gazidis decided to fuck off to AC Milan, he said, Sanjay, he's a good guy, put him in charge, and they went, okay, because you said so, rather than saying, well, you know, hang on, let's have a think about this. Who is the best person that we could put in charge of our football club? Who is the best person to be, you know, the technical director or the sporting director or what have you, to sort of take on board a holistic approach to this rebuilding of the football club? And I think that's sort of where I come back to where you have some sympathy for Arteta, and I think I do too, in that he recognizes the issues and he recognizes the flaws and he's taken on the responsibility. And it's probably too much too soon for a guy of his age, of his relative inexperience. But what he saw was, well, there's nobody else. There's nobody else to do this work. and I'll try my best to do it. And I think he's been caught between two stools in some ways. And again, this isn't to defend the results or anything that we've had on the pitch. And, you know, the big problem is that the executive structures at the football club, like if you say tomorrow Arteta's gone, who's making the decision? Who's making the decision to, like, what do we do now? Do we have a technical? Do we have a technical director who is complicit in one of the worst signings that we've ever made in Willian? You know, this is not a healthy football club right now, leaving aside the Arteta thing.
No, absolutely. And there's only four things that need to be changed at Arsenal. The owners, the execs, the manager and the players. And if we do all that, we'll be fine. which you know, I say that jokingly, but it's kind of true. And really, you'd like to change those one at a time, and you'd like to be able to do it all overnight. But we probably accept that the owners aren't going anywhere. I personally don't see that this Daniel Ek bid is going to cut any water at all. So yes, then it becomes about the executive layer of the club. And with all of this, I think the situation we're in is just throwing enough shit at the wall until some sticks, because we know that Josh Kroenke and Stan Kroenke do not have the expertise. That Stan Kroenke is not really interested. Josh Kroenke, Josh Kroenke is rich because of inherited wealth. It's not anything he did. And I think that shows, really, to be honest. Like, I don't particularly think... I'm not majorly impressed by him. So what we've got to hope is that they get lucky and that they just eventually maybe get this right, whether that be through the right execs or the right manager. When you look at the technical director appointment, I mean, not a lot of imagination there. It's like, well, Monchi, he's the biggest name in this role. Let's try and get him. And he's only actually properly worked at one club. So that, you know, there's not really any guarantee that he'd have been any good at Arsenal. And then they didn't get him. And it's like, well, Edu used to play for us, didn't he? Invincibles, everyone loves them. Let's put him in. So, you know, you can follow the thinking there. And Tayo used the word stasis there. And it's a real, I don't know about everyone else, I've been feeling like a real existential issue over the last few weeks with the kind of rebirth of the Kroenke out protests, because we're protesting about getting rid of the owners, and I want rid of the owners because I think they're shit at this. They're just not very good at running, not even football clubs. They don't run their sports clubs very well at all. And a lot of Stan Kroenke's wealth is inherited as well, by the way. So, not perhaps the business brain that everyone might think, but then it's kind of, then Daniel Ek comes in and you think, well, do I want him really? Do I would just want, and you know, we've talked about this to death really, that kind of, well, who do I want running the club? I don't really know. And it's kind of that feeling of existential torpor that actually even getting rid of the Kroenkes, as unlikely as that is really only part of the battle. Because then it's like, well, who comes in? And I feel the same at exec level, because we don't have that expertise in the club. I mean, we could sack Edu tomorrow. And I don't think he could complain. Like, just from a pure business perspective, in any other business, you know, even a semi-engaged owner would rock up and say, I see you're spend. You know, you convinced us to spend 200 grand a week on Willian, and I don't know a lot about football, but I can see he scored zero goals this season. What the fuck are you doing with the club's money? Even a semi-engaged owner might consider that, you know, bordering on a sackable offence. But then, who the hell are they going to appoint? And it's the same with Arteta, right? It's exactly the same. Like, I think he can't have any complaints if he's sacked this morning. He really can't. And I think he knows that. But then who the hell do we get in afterwards? And who the hell has the level of expertise to tempt someone, to say, hi, our club's a complete tire fire. We've been in decline for years now. We don't even have Europe next season. Our squad's a complete mess. Who wants to come and manage us? And by the way, because we don't have Europe next year and everyone's season tickets are so much cheaper, we don't even have that much money for you. Like, it's not a great sell, even if we had great brains. So it's, I'm sorry that's not a particularly cheery answer, but it really, like, it really feels a bit, it feels a bit like the game, right? It feels like, yes, you know, Pepe's going to have to smash one in from 30 yards, or Aubameyang's going to have to produce something out of nothing. That's how I feel about the exec level of the club. Like, you know, someone's just going to have to pull a rabbit out of a hat almost by accident.
It also felt like, you mentioned the game, watching the club was like watching the game yesterday, in the sense of feeling powerless, thinking, seeing that really obvious things aren't being done, and we have nothing to do about it, and we have nothing that we can do about it. I guess that was what was encouraging, excuse me, about the protests the other week. I can't help thinking back to like the little shareholders that we used to have, one of them who, you know, people who had one share, two shares, and that was such a big, you know, that was such a big deal for them. Someone I do a podcast with, of course, Alan, was one of those. And we were talking, I remember how disappointed he was at just having that symbolism taken away. And when those, you know, when our club was bought lock, stock and barrel by the Americans, and the way that fans no longer have nothing, anything to, it's almost like they're saying it's not nothing to do with you anymore. And it really feels like that. And I mean, I'll be making a podcast about the Knicks, New York Knicks at the moment. And any of our American viewers will recognize the problems with one of their owners, James Dolan. And if you're a basketball fan, and I always used to wonder, maybe because we had that shield before of Arsene Wenger, to think that what a difference that ownership can make, and how it has eroded the quality and the values at the club. And I if you want to see it kind of writ large, looking, you've seen that in American sports, and you've seen people talking about American owners before. And I mentioned James Dolan and the New York Knicks. We are seeing that with our own club now, where as a result of the kind of torpor and inertia at the top, there's this complete erratic appointments and administration at exec level, which has come down to management level, which we're now seeing every day or every week on the pitch. It really has started from the top, and I'm surprised that it has come so far up. Like, if you want to talk about trickle down, this torpor has trickled down from the very top to what we saw last night.
Tim, I mean, is it unreasonable for me to suggest that, given their experience in sporting club / franchise ownership and business as a whole, and the ability, KSE. And all the associated businesses and Kroenke's property businesses and everything else, I'm sure have very smart, intelligent people running them at a profit to make money. So is it not beyond the realms of possibility that, you know, there are people out there, there are experts in football and football club consultancy and executive consultancy that Arsenal and KSE, let's be clear, this is on them, could put in place a hiring process. You know, they could get executives, they could get consultants to make recommendations and do interviews and do all the things that normal people have to do to get jobs. I know football is a weird and strange industry, and there's a lot of like, well, this guy knows this guy and he's good, so bring him in, or, you know, well, he's available, so we'll just get that guy. But there's no reason why those kind of processes can't work at a football club, if you're so inclined to make them.
No, indeed. And I mean, I guess one thing they did, they appointed Tim Lewis, right? And how long after that did Raul Sanyehi pack up his desk?
And they are bringing in Richard Garlick to the executive team. Quite what he's going to do, I don't know. But, you know, there is some football experience there, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they are appointing people. They're just not appointing the right people. And we hope that, I mean, I don't think Tim Lewis is going to turn us into title challengers or anything, but we can but hope that they're the right people. But absolutely, absolutely. That is the absolute bare minimum due diligence you would do is to say, okay, we don't really know this sport. You know, we own a load of US sports and they're set up in a certain way. They're set up in a way that enable owners to make lots of money. And, you know, the really worrying thing is that the Cronkies have already shown their hand with the Super League thing. That I mean that's been obvious for a long time, I think, anyway, but they've shown their hand that their plan was never to try and turn Arsenal into a competitive team. It was to try and make the game less competitive. That's that's what billionaires tend to do, right? They take the money, then they change the rules of the game. And that was their end game. We can see that now. Well, I think we always saw that, but we know it for a fact now. I guess the only hope that we have, if they're serious about building bridges with supporters again, this is an ideal opportunity to look engaged again, to look busy, you know, to look like you're doing something. This is a very critical moment for them in terms of whether they care about fan opinion. I just don't think they do. I don't believe a word that comes out of Josh Kroenke's mouth. No words come out of Stan Kroenke's mouth, so there's no issue of trust with what he says there because he didn't say anything. So this would at least be an opportunity. Like, if they're actually serious about even turning the tide of fan opinion, this is a real opportunity for them. You know, this is an opportunity for them to say, right. And I'm not necessarily advocating for them to make populist moves that just look like they're doing something, but they could just go, right, okay, ninth, out of the Europa League semi-final, not good enough. We're setting the standard now. That is not good enough for Arsenal. You get sacked. That's the end of it. We want to do much better. But none of us expect that, do we? No. We all expect them to just go, yeah, well, we'll just see how it goes, like we always do. And yeah, then we'll probably just wait until it's too late and everything's on fire and in ashes on the ground. And then we'll, you know, maybe we'll turn on a water hose after that.
Yeah. It's a series of rock bottoms.
Yeah.
You talk about getting lucky with a Pepe 30-yarder. They might get lucky with Haaland. We might get lucky because instead of 200 million, which they would never magic up anyway, we've got that in our ranks.
Yeah, I mean, the other side of that is that they might look at Haaland as a way of offsetting some of the financial impact of, you know, this season and what's happening. So I don't necessarily want to go down that road because that's even more depressing than I thought. But look, it is what it is. Look, I've kept you guys too long today, and I really appreciate you being here. I was going to maybe say, look, is there any reason or any hope for optimism? But I think that can wait for another day. We've gone full doom on here, and we can...
Yeah. What I'll tell you, Andrew, is that obviously they're in the process of hiring a new manager for the women's team, and I'll keep a close eye on that because that, for me, is a big litmus test of their competence.
Yeah.
And there are good choices and there are bad choices they can make, and we'll find out in the next couple of weeks. And, you know, maybe that will confirm our suspicions or maybe it will give us a beacon of hope.
All right. Well, look, we'll wait and see what happens. We all look forward, I'm sure, to the game against West Brom on Sunday, where we don't even have Ainsley playing to make it interesting. But what can you do? Tayo, thank you very much indeed, as always. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
And Tim, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure, as always.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog.
Thank you very much indeed to Tayo. You can find him on Twitter at DJ Tayo, at DJ Tayo, and Tim is at Stilberto, as I'm sure you know. Right. I think we're going to leave it there. I'm all talked out. I don't know what more I can say. I don't know what fresh opinion I can offer on anything at this point. Need a little bit of time to just sort of let things digest and then come out the other end in whatever form they're going to come out. We do have a game on Sunday. We will try and preview it on Patreon. I'm not quite sure how we're going to do that yet, but look, we're in it for the good times and the bad times. These are some bad times, my friends. But look, we'll do our best. We'll do our best to provide some kind of preview podcast tomorrow on Patreon. It will not be today. As ever, look, thank you very much indeed for listening. I can't even be arsed to do an end bit for this particular episode. It is beyond me. I can't. I don't know. Thank you, as always, for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for your support and all your comments and tweets and everything else. I hope you've enjoyed this, despite the fact it's been far from the cheeriest podcast we've ever done. And it is a long, long way from the kind of podcast I was hoping we'd be able to do today, given that we could have reached a European final last night. Okay, listen, I'm going to leave it there. Until the next one, folks, take it easy. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.